Hello, this is Kyle Jones. We are in our Refortification of the Bible series, where we are giving you strong posits, or positing, or placements of facts, linguistically, etymologically, grammatically, historically, etc., to support the malliances that have occurred from our society to the biblical text. And of course, as I have taught my students for years, we never place our ideas that are extra-biblical to the biblical text if we are to honestly titrate, to pull out, to extract truths and facts and ideas that are integrated, if you will. They are infigured or figurated to the story. The story has its proper calculus, and for us to put our ideas to the calculus that has held its own self together for millennia is to do the biblical text a great injustice. My second statement before we get to the class is that I always refer back to Colossians chapter 1, verse 18, when I'm using mythologies from other cultures, such as Sumeria, Akkadia, the Canaanite mythologies, Greek, Roman, etc. I believe that all things were created for, of, and by Jesus for His love to us, and for His love from us to Him, that we may adorate, we may adore Him. And this can be seen, again, in Colossians chapter 1, verse 18. Therefore, when we quote the Sumerian accounts and the Greek accounts, the Babylonian accounts, we're getting an account of either received tales, mythologies, of the hope of the Messiah that can be seen in its portentous call of the biblical text. Jesus answered to this call in and of the biblical account, not the Sumerian account, not the Babylonian account, in its totality. Though the ocular observance, the oracular observance of the early Sumerians, I do believe, was the account of people who lived contemporaneously with Adam and Eve and their children, seeing Adam and Eve, and seeing the Yahweh God that dealt with Adam and Eve and their children. It is very valuable to me to know that if God created these accounts under His authority, under His sovereign, predetermined, predestinational hand, that we should take these mythologies very seriously. Not that the God was born in Sumeria, such as the Messiah, but the hope of the Messiah was given in the sketches and the shadows and the archetypes of these early cultures. Without any further ado, I will start our lecture on the account of Eve as coming from the rib of Adam. The Hebrew name of the first woman is Chawa. Jewish tradition links this very rare name with the prime verbal root to make live, hence Chaya in Hebrew, which also is an Akkadian word. This concept is no doubt connected with Eve's magnificent epithet or title, as we see in Genesis chapter 3, verse 20. Adam named his wife Chawa because she was, quote, the mother of all the living, end quote. And we can see this phrase in the Hebrew, Em Kal He, which simply means the mother of all the living. Is it pure coincidence that the mother of all the living is precisely the title borne by the Sumerian name Ninhurzag, which means the lady of life-bearing, or the lady of the mountain, who gives birth. Earlier in Genesis chapter 2, verses 21 through 23, we can read of the creation of Eve. The first woman and great mother is not formed from clay or the earth like her male counterpart, but from the rib of man. Yahweh God made the man, Adam, fall into a deep sleep. And while he was asleep, he took one of his ribs and closed the flesh up again forthwith. Yahweh God fashioned the rib he had taken from the man into a woman and brought her to the man. And the man said, quote, "This one at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She is to be taken and called woman." Her name in Hebrew is Isha, which of course means the man of, or simply of the man, because she was taken from the man. Well, there's our Genesis account in Genesis chapter 2. Verses 21 again through 23. And we can find it here to be a very remarkable parallel between the Sumerian myth, the paradise myth. But this time, the extra-biblical account or text provides a fascinating explanation for the strange biblical motif of woman being crafted from the rib of man. In the Sumerian version, we find that Enki, who we can also identify with either as Yahweh by some scholars and others as Satan, the snake. And it's up for grabs because, once again, here we go with a cultural, aporia. We have a kind of a blank hole as to how that we're going to place these titles with people. But I think that the concept is in the names and the functions, and seeing how the culture began to worship not just the God on the mountain, but the people with might. And I think that hero worship began almost instantaneously once mankind saw the relationship between Adam and Eve and Yahweh God. But nonetheless, here we go. We can identify this Enki either with Yahweh or Satan. And we see that this Enki is cursed by the great mother goddess Ninhursag in the Sumerian account, not the biblical account. But we do see Adam being cursed in the biblical account, and which puts it more so on Enki or the snake. The snake was cursed the most, and he was told to crawl on his belly for the rest of his days. Nonetheless, Ninhursag, because he has eaten forbidden plants growing in paradise, shall be cursed. Dr. Samuel Noah Kramer, the translator of the text, notes yet another parallel with the biblical paradise myth. As he states here, in his Sumerian mythologies, Enki's eating of the eight plants and the curse uttered against him for his misdeed recall the eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge by Adam and Eve, and the curse is pronounced against each of them for this sinful action. Now, Kramer is going more so for Adam here, but then again, I've stated in the past that very well could be Enki, the one with power, would have been Satan, or the Korubi, or the great cherub, who was considered to be as the Most High, or like God, or likened to God. Enki's health, as we see in this Enuma Elish, begins to fail, and the other gods realize that he is dying. They persuade Ninhursag, that is the mother of all living, to relent, and she sets about the task of cursing Enki's sickness, creating a goddess called Ninti to cure his failing bones. Now, right here, we have Ninti. I will explain what she means by name. Now, by the way, let me just precurse this. There is the account in the Sumerian account here of creation, paradise, a time before Adam, where there is already a curse taking place. Now, again, we have to rectify with the Bible these personages, but I'll continue that in a moment. My brother Inky, what hurts you? Well, my rib hurts me, Nin-Herzog. To the goddess Ninti, lady of the rib, I, Nin-Herzog, have given birth for you. Well, now the word for rib in Sumerian is T-I, if you will, for us, which happens also to be the Sumerian verb to make live or to make live. And this would have been the name for Eve. So, the Mesopotamian author of the myth is employing, if you will, a pun or a play on words to equate the, quote, lady of the rib as a high title, Ninti, with the lady who makes alive, Ninti. So here, we do have a fix on the languages of Eve to the mother of all living, to also the lady of the rib, and to the Sumerian account. So here, to enter the biblical account, here we go. That this is the goddess who brings Enki back to life from his near-death condition. Now, I would say that this might very well be Adam's frustration, his frustration in not having a helpmate. So, again, we are taking an extra-biblical account of an optical and oracular observance and taking note of by one of the Emmanuans, one of the, or many of the Emmanuans, or secretaries, or redactionists of the Sumerian culture. So it is possible to have a mixture or a malconfiguration of some sort of the meaning of the story. And it's just like when we read stories, if we understand the gist, the geist, the ghost, the general gestalt of this of the tale, we can put the facts together. But nonetheless, they were people taking into account what they believed they saw. Well, when Kramer first translated, that's Dr. Samuel Noah Kramer, the ancient text of the Sumerian paradise myth called the Enuma Elish, we can also find in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is accounted for by A.R. George. It's a pretty expensive a two-volume set, around about $400. I bought it not too long ago, and it's just the most brilliant treatment ever on Sumerian and the Babylonian or slash Akkadian text of the creation of the world from these beautiful pagan cultures. And I say pagan not in the immoral sense, but pagan or paganus, meaning of another place, even maybe country dwellers or people who are not in the know of the biblical story. Well, anyway, he immediately saw what was going on here with the parallels. He saw that in these passages, an explanation for the biblical story of Adam's rib, right here. The author, or the later redactor of Genesis, when he adapted this myth in order to incorporate the elements of it into the biblical narrative, he was clearly unaware of the fact that the Sumerian tale involved a play on words, and so simply translated T as rib. Thus, Eve is created from a rib, and because there is no similarity between the Hebrew words for rib, tsalah, and to make live, chaya, the pun is therefore lost. What remains of the hidden meaning, however, is the epithet, quote, mother of all living, end quote, which is itself the predominant attribute of the great mother goddess Nin-Herzog, also known as Nintu and Mammy, who bears the epithet mother of all offspring. And in the Sumerian, we call it Ana Duma Duma Ene. It seems, then, that Eve may have begun her existence in the literature of mankind as a goddess. But because of the monotheistic tenets of the Israelite religion and the endowed truths that the Yahweh God of this beautiful cult has mandated and dictated, this woman becomes humanized and made mortal, versus that of the Sumerians who were pantheists, who began to worship everything, all things, living, dead, as something to do with a god. Anyway, and although retaining this Eve, this Chaya, this Ninti, she does retain the mother of all living. And this term is therefore demoted by Sumerian standards to the role of a spouse to the first man to be made of the clay by the God of creation. Now, as I've stated before, I think that the role of marriage is the meaning of all things. The marriage consists of the relationship between God and us. And if we can understand the grammar of marriage, we can understand the story. There is nothing exclusively bad about stating that she is the spouse of Adam and that Adam is her husband. This is where the meaning, the significance of life begins, of the creation of life and the cycle of life and the archetypes of how all things in the universe are done. So anyway, we see two comparative cultures coming together in some form of force to support at least the meaning of what rib means, and to understand that these tales, these myths, and these stories that are true and are literally real were told from and in the Sumerian language. And as I've stated before, in the Sumerian language, we had many patois, many dialects. Some were of the Ibaru cult. Some of them were of the Semitic forming cult. Some of them were more Indo-Aryan. Some were more Tocrian or Asiatic. Nonetheless, these tales, these stories, these old words in an old archaic language are time-capsulized for us to open and to see and to enjoy, that the biblical accounts are supported in every culture. My final statement that seems to fit the creation of man itself, and from this man we have birth, is the very word for rib. We have a pre-alphabetic language called rebus or charade. Some people call it charade. Nonetheless, we have three stages, main stages of language. One is just simply drawing a picture of what is seen in front of the Immanuan or the secretary or redactor. The second one is pictures that can be pronounced to categorize another idea. And then finally we have the alphabet, which is simply phonetic. It produces a sound and that's all, without any other meaning. Now the complexity between the post-charade or charade or rebus to the alphabet is where I find the interplay between Sumerian, Hebrew, Akkadian very interesting as to how that we took the pictures to the sounds. Nonetheless, we can depict and capture the meaning of rib in three letters. Tzla. We have tza, tzade, as the TS sound. It is a picture of a man lying down on the ground in some form of sleep. The next, lamet. It's a shepherd's hook or a device to rally in, to move, to provoke, to push, to prod, to work with a device. And the last one, the ayin or the means an eye. It's a picture of an eye. And it happens to do with something inside of the eye, the apple of your eye, that which is blessed, that which is in the center of the eye. The baba is a good concept of the apple of the ayin, baba. The baba min ayin. Nonetheless, we have a man sleeping on his side, a tool being used by a shepherd. It's a shepherd's hook. And then we have the apple of the eye, or that which is pleasing to the eye. And this ayin is used many times for the eye of God. So if we want to put that together, we would have man lying down, being used of a tool, and the happiness, the joy of the work that was done. This is the post rebus or charade for the meaning of the word rib in the archaic Hebrew language or Hebrew language. Thank you very much. This is Kyle Jones.